Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a really amazing founder. My God, he's done so many transactions, you know, so many companies that he started, companies that also he's led. You know, we're talking about exits, you know, in the hundreds of millions, okay? So I think that we have quite a very inspiring journey from, you know, basically his first meetings with VCs, with the likes of Sequoia, to, for example, raising money, how to think about raising money, how to think about doing exits, and also the timings of those exits, and then also how to deal with absolute catastrophe and craziness. They were actually caught on the Silicon Valley Bank, you know, craziness, and from one day to another, there was no money. Money was gone. So again, you know, incredible conversation ahead of us. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Amish Devatia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Alejandro. Glad to be here.
So originally born in India. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
Life was interesting, never without challenges, as you can imagine. Those were the days when you don't have the India of today, right? That those were challenging times back then. But we never knew about it. So one thing we did know very clearly is if you make it out of college, the first thing you want to do is go to the U.S., which is exactly what I did. A week after I graduated from engineering school, I was in the U.S. Going to graduate school.
So then let's talk about that. How was that? Was that a big culture shock to come here to the U.S.? How was that change for you?
Well, it wasn't really as much of a culture shock, other than the fact that, there were aspects of it. But in general, we were very exposed to U.S. influences. In fact, growing up, one of the biggest things that I remember while I was just graduating high school and getting ready to figure out what to do is Time magazine, declaring the computer as the man of the year, if you will. So there were a lot of influences of what would be considered American culture. But coming to California was definitely different because I always imagined America would be like New York. Long story short, though, couldn't have imagined a better experience about the kind of opportunities that were available out here. So I pursued what I thought was my passion, which was communication networking, very early days of doing all of that, and graduated. Actually, before I graduated, I had an amazing internship experience, which really made me think about actually not going to school anymore any longer than I had to. I got my master's and got out. I was not the PhD types. So got to Silicon Valley, actually, thankfully, because I was in Southern California. The only jobs out there were for people who were born here or were citizens. So moved to the Valley, and the rest, as they say, is history.
So in your case, you know, you got started as a developer, and then all of a sudden, you know, you find yourself being an architect. Then, you know, you decided to start your first company in the late 90s. You know, I'm sure it was a little bit of a different environment. You know, what you were seeing. I'm sure that the venture capital ecosystem was not as developed. But hey, it was your first company, which also had a really nice exit. So Pipelinks, what were you guys doing at Pipelinks?
All right. So, yeah, it didn't happen overnight. I started out, focused on communication networking, started out as a support engineer, made my way into design, and then eventually system architecture. And about 7 years into it, I decided, okay, there's just so much stuff going on around us in terms of new ideas that I want to give it a shot just to figure out how to start a company and come up with, I had lots of ideas. But it was hard. It was really hard to let go of that, you know, that support lifeline, right? Your job. So I go up to my boss. This was a company called 3Com, which, by the way, was super successful, which is why I did have a little bit of a nest egg. The stock was doubling every year. And I told my boss, I want to go do this, but I'm really scared. And he gave me an opportunity that I will never, ever forget, which is he said, just go, come back in a month if you don't like it. So I stepped out, and actually that's when the ideas really became reality. What I always tell first-time entrepreneurs especially is there's only so much you can do while you have a job. Of course, for legal reasons, you shouldn't be doing that. But even from a mind space perspective, you want to be able to do it full-time, be able to really put in the effort, because by the way, that's what the investors look at as well. If you're still hanging around in your job and trying to think of things to do, the investor is also going to look at it differently. Like, okay, this guy's trying, but not quite fully committed, right? So that's really the turning point. I got out there. It took me a full 6 months to actually come up with an idea. But then I was confident enough to say, okay, so Pipelinks was a concept of actually being able to create what eventually became something known as a multi-service provisioning platform, where what you do is you take in traffic from corporate environments and you pipe it into the telecom network. This is the early days of the internet, where you know, it costs a lot of money to actually be able to get connectivity. But everybody had a voice line coming into their environments. So what we figured out is to build a product where you could have one single pipe from the telecom provider where you can do both voice and data. And you do data with the same kind of service level guarantees that voice has, which is really what made it more enterprise-class. So that's what Pipelinks meant.
So then let's talk about there, you know, because with Pipelinks also, it was pretty interesting. I mean, the first VC meeting in your life, you know, it happens at none other place than Sequoia, you know, one of the best venture capitals of all time. I mean, how was that experience for you?
Crazy story. So, and there's a lesson to be learned here as well, because I think a lot of entrepreneurs feel like, you know, these VC meetings are like Shark Tank, like happen, you know, you go in there and you walk out with a check. It never happens like that. You've got to make sure that you have all the groundwork done. And then the VC meeting and, you know, the actual commitment is just a formality. In our case, what happened was my co-founder and I basically came up with this idea, fine-tuned it, and got Cisco fully committed to it. So Pipelinks is actually a Stanford School of Business case study, where Cisco wanted to get into a new space. They wanted to get into the telecom business. They were mostly a data networking company. And they would do these kind of projects where they would fund a company and create a product that can be brought, can leverage from what they have and brought to a new market. So we went to Cisco and convinced them about this particular concept. And again, the right things aligned. Timing was great, but I do give it give them a lot of credit. They were always that forward-looking company that, you know, wants to get in new markets. So they basically said, yep, we'll invest, but we need a VC to keep us all honest. So here's the deal. Introduced us to the Sequoia partner and said, Monday morning, 8:30, show up and pitch. And we showed up and that room was full of every Sequoia partner that was out there. Don Valentine, the god of venture capital, was there right at the back. Very interestingly, he asked only one question. He asked my co-founder and I how long we have known each other. This is very important when you're trying to build that founding team. You want to bring people that you really, first of all, trust, and you can show how you'll be able to work together. Because the founding journey is not easy. There's going to be lots of problems. There's going to be lots of twists and turns. And if there's founder dynamics that are in trouble, you know, great ideas can fail. In our case, I was lucky. My co-founder was my kindergarten classmate. So it made for a really good story. But by the way, the path forward was not without twists and turns. He had to come up to me and have me, you know, do things that, you know, we had to do for the good of the company, which it required a lot of sacrifices and a lot of hard decisions to be made. But that dynamic is very, very critical when you're starting a company.
Oh, man, 100%. Now, in your case, you know, with this company, it ended up being a really nice, successful outcome because the company ended up getting acquired for $126 million by Cisco. So I'm wondering, like, obviously, first company, first exit. Make us insiders for a bit there. I mean, how was it like going through that process?
To be perfectly honest, it was somewhat unbelievable, right? I mean, again, this is 1999, so crazy things were happening around us. But still, getting there was certainly surreal. In some ways, it felt like it was too easy, to be perfectly honest, just because it happened so fast. And it was the first time, for me at least, that it had happened. So, but again, absolutely no complaints. It was great to have that happen. And I made actually a strategic decision for my career to switch from being a technologist to go onto the business side. So I used the opportunity to be at Cisco to be on the marketing side, product specifically, to learn how product works, how marketing works, because that's something that I had not been exposed to. So yeah, one of the things that people always talk about is the honeymoon, right? When you first get acquired, you go through this honeymoon stage where you are the darling of the company, right? You get invited to all kinds of events, and every sales guy wants you to go come talk with a customer. It was amazing. But again, it doesn't last. There came a point where reality had to come through, and we had to actually show exactly what we were able to do in terms of creating new markets.
So as they say, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. I mean, in your case, you had to do the vesting and resting for a little bit with Cisco, just a couple of years. Some people, rest more than others. I'm sure that at Cisco, maybe, like you didn't have that much time. But in this case, you decided, to go at it again with Arohi Communications. So at what point do you realize, that that's the next, best chapter for you in your entrepreneurial journey?
Very simple. 2001. My boss at that time comes to me and said, look, times are really, really, really tough. And what we're going to do is shut down everything that is forward looking. So we're going to milk what we have in the product line. And we want to shut down everything that that you were looking at as sort of the next gen and beyond. So I had the choice to go and, go milk what we had versus do something different. Having done it once, it's a hell of a lot easier to do it again. And this is where, again, I have a lot of respect for the people who give you that first chance. And it's not just about the first chance for the first company. Even when you are starting a company, the first check, the person who writes the first check, in my mind, is the one that takes the most risk. So I decided to go and help another team that I had seed funded. This is something that also happens, right? Once you make a commitment to somebody else, it's very important to follow through with it. The Valley, especially, is a very small place. Word travels fast. You want to make sure that your reputation is the most important thing that's out there. So I decided to join this team that had seed funded, and raising money was actually a lot easier than the first time around. I did not have to wait those 6 months to get that going. And very interestingly, the biggest thing about entrepreneurship is the ebbs and the flows, right? So we close this round and we're ready to get going. We have $15 million in the bank. And 10 days later, 9/11 happens, which completely changes everything. Again, the market was starting to slow down, but that was sort of, everything came to a screeching halt. So again, we luckily had the money in the bank, so we weathered it through. But I still feel like in my 25 years of doing this, that was probably 2002 was probably the worst time to be raising money or being in the entrepreneurial business. So it was really lots of lessons learned. Now, if Pipelinks was easy, this was much, much harder because of the macro. This is something I always tell entrepreneurs all the time. If you are going to do something, you always have to watch the macro as to what's going on and adjust accordingly, because those are things that you can never control.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So obviously, you know, you got to control whatever is in front of you, right? But I mean, what a tremendous journey there, you know, and a great exit to Emulex to, you know, there for $39 million. Now, in your career, you know, obviously one of the things that is very interesting is that you've had the opportunity to look at things as well, you know, on the investor side, whether you were an entrepreneur in residence, you know, with Artiman Ventures, or later on, you know, you would also be a partner at Incarta, where you were looking at more of the early stage companies at a seed level. But one of the things that was kind of like a little of a different approach to the venture mentality, whether it was on one side or on the other on the table, was the route that you decided to take when you took on the CEO role at Lightwire, which was kind of like a turnaround that ended up being a really nice exit to another company, none other than one called Cisco. So so basically, why were you brought in? What were you encounter when you were brought in? And how did you go about turning things around to get things to the finish line?
Yeah, so you know, one of the things I've always done, and this is something I advise everybody, whether they're an entrepreneur or not, is when you start your first job and when you proceed in your career, always look for the big picture. In large companies, especially, it's very easy to get slotted into a little role where you're doing something that you're doing. And, you know, if you're happy with that, you'll never grow. You want to find out what is it that you're doing and what impact it has to the overall product and eventually to the overall strategy. So this is something that I always wanted to do all along, where, you know, that's how I grew in my career. And then when I exited ROE, actually spent 2 good years at Emulex doing the corporate thing. And it's something you should also do when you're doing multiple companies. You want to make sure that you get a variety of experiences, because the entrepreneurial journey is not easy. You need to recharge. So I decided that I was going to go and look for a different role on the investing side, and quickly figured out the best part about in the investing side is variety. Right? You talk to very smart people and you learn a lot every day and you get a lot of different experiences there. But it is still a passive role. So at Lightwire, I was trying to help that company by being an advisor, but very quickly figured out that when I went out to help them raise money, the investors would look at me and say, well, what do you have to offer? I mean, what's your skin in the game here? So very quickly, I figured out that if I really wanted to make an impact, I needed to jump in, which wasn't a surprise, but it's something that I did try to avoid for a while. So Lightwire was actually a very, very innovative company. It is by far the most innovative, and something that, it is something that changed the world, if you will. So we were in a situation where we had some tremendous technology, tremendous innovation, but we couldn't find a very good path to market. So I was brought in because, again, our friends at Cisco were interested in a very specific innovation. and they were willing to put money where their mouth was, write a big check, and they wanted to make sure that they had somebody that they had worked with before who they could trust. And that's how I got in there. And then once I was in there, there was a lot of painful decisions to make because this was, again, a very technology-driven company. It had a lot of different things, and we had to shut everything down except for what Cisco, as the partner at that time, was willing to fund and willing to work with us on. So for engineers, it's very hard to tell them, hey, this thing is not going to go forward. But we did that. I give the team a lot of credit. Not only did they do that, they actually focused and executed flawlessly so that we delivered exactly what we had promised. And at that point, surprising to us, because Cisco is not somebody who's interested in components, they decided to integrate vertically and incorporate that team into their organization and acquired the company.
And obviously, quite the acquisition, $271 million. Now, there was a little get-together, a little gathering there that happened to celebrate that, you know, at an Italian restaurant. And quite a coincidence that you also happened to have an exchange with one of the Italian executives. You know, it was quite a surprise, you know, for them. But what did you tell them?
Well, one of the things about entrepreneurship is, you know, you get very attached to what you're doing. And when I did Lightwire, I was all in. This company was not even in the Valley, right? It was in Pennsylvania. So I spent a year and a half commuting. So I had a lot invested in it. But once the acquisition happened, one of the things I realized was I didn't want to go back to corporate life and be, you know, again. I give Cisco a lot of credit for thinking ahead and making that bet. So I wanted to make sure that our champion at Cisco had a clean slate to run the company and run that team. So, you know, this was, you know, Italian restaurant we were at, and my champion happened to be Italian. And I just said, well, think of this as a big Italian wedding where I'm going to be giving away the bride. And that's the end of it. After that, you take it from there. Fortunately, he was very understanding of that. And actually, that particular product has absolutely thrived inside of Cisco. It's created a massive product line. So it was a good story. But one of the things was that we want to make sure. Well, one of the funny parts was my CTO, who was the founder of the company, was somebody that I felt strongly that they should keep. So I said, well, the bride goes with you, which is the company, but the father of the bride goes with it. So that was the handoff. And it was very hard at first for me because it felt like, okay, is this baby going to be maintained properly? And I was very happy a few years later to hear how well that company had done inside.
That's amazing. And nothing like setting up expectations right off the bat. So good stuff. Now, in your case, this was a really nice sequence, you know, or segue, you know, that would ended up propelling you to your next company, a company that you're running now, that you've created, co-founded, called Baffle. So for the people listening, what is Baffle? What are you guys doing at Baffle, and what is the business model?
Well, as the name suggests, we confuse hackers. What we do is build a product where your most important asset, which is your data, is protected. So the cybersecurity market, if you will, is very, very big from the perspective of the number of companies out there and the number of solutions that are out there. But as you also know, the hacks are not ending. In fact, there's a lot of backlash right now about the fact that we're spending over $100 billion in cybersecurity spending, but the hacks continue to happen. One of the big reasons is because most cybersecurity solutions are all about observation. It's about making sure that you have a security guard in front of your asset to make sure that they monitor who's going in and out. Well, as we know from other examples as well, that's not the best way to protect your asset. The best way to protect your asset is to disguise it in such a way that when the hacker gets in there, he thinks it's just rocks, but within the rock is gold. So that's what Baffle does. We protect data at the record level, at the field level, and we do that by either encrypting it, tokenizing it, or masking it. what we do depends on how the data is going to be used downstream. And we do it all the way down at the field level. So when that data ends up in the cloud, for example, nobody can see it, including the cloud administrator. This is becoming a massive requirement now for enterprises as they migrate more and more assets to the cloud, where they want a cryptographic guarantee that the cloud service provider actually cannot see their data. I'm not suggesting the cloud service provider either wants to see the data or wants to steal data, because you know there are rules about how they work. But what you worry about is somebody pretending to be the cloud service provider's administrator by phishing them or somehow getting the credentials of the infrastructure administrators. With a solution like Baffle, what would happen is that the cloud service provider's admin would just see encrypted data or tokenized data. So that even if somebody pretending to be them get access to it, the data is useless, number one. Number two, when that data is exfiltrated, since the data is useless, there is no notification requirement. A lot of companies suffer tremendous reputation damage. It takes them years to mend that. You know, think Target, think Equifax, because of the fact that they lost their customers' data. If you lose your customers' data, but it happens to be encrypted, you don't have to notify anybody. So it's really making sure that you create that proactive security posture and protect the data all the way down at the record level.
So for this, you guys have raised a bit of money. So how much have you raised? And obviously at this point, you're what is called a tier zero founder, where you can like literally grab money from any investor that you want. So how did you go about, you know, picking up the people that you're going to kind of be marrying and going to the wedding, you know, with?
Well, while I'd love to say that it's easier, it's not easy. So once they look at your track record, yes, they do trust you. But at the same time, you have to be able to demonstrate that you're really building a business, especially in a field like cybersecurity, where, you know, you have almost 3,000 startups now. You know, you want to make sure that, number one, you're differentiated. You know, the technology is something that is unique. You have a barrier to entry. Number two, you have a team that actually has credibility and it's the ability to actually execute. And number three, and the most important one, that you're building a large market. So the way we convinced investors to invest in this is, you know, we're sort of turning the whole model on its head. Typically, as I said, security is all about monitoring. You talk about which security requirements you're adhering to, and that's important. But we turn the model on its head and the solution is actually built into the data pipeline. So what we are saying is this is not something that is dependent on your security budget. It really is just an adder to your infrastructure budget. It's part of the data pipeline. So as soon as data is created, you want to protect it so that you can never, ever be considered liable for it. The secret sauce, though, is how you can actually process that data. Data is ingested into data pipelines, sent to the cloud for a very specific reason. The reason is that you want to actually either process it or share it. So what we have figured out is a way to actually process that data in the cloud without, again, anybody seeing it. The concept is known as privacy-preserving analytics, where you're able to get insight from data without actually decrypting it. So that's the secret sauce. When it comes to the next gen of analytics, which is really any kind of LLM interactions or generative AI, now it's become a requirement that you have to share data. And so that's where this solution becomes even more critical, because now you can share data without actually compromising on the privacy of the people who actually provided that data to you, your customers.
So then in this case, you know, with the company, with Baffle, you know, one of the toughest moments that you guys had to encounter was the catastrophe, you know, that really unfolded once Silicon Valley Bank, you know, went down. You know, how was that for you guys and how did you manage that crisis?
That was surreal. It was exactly a year ago now. And actually, the rumor started to swirl that this might happen. And I actually collected my team and told them this is never going to happen. You know, this is a very conservative bank. This bank will never, ever go under. What I did not understand at that point is actually there is no bank in the world that can survive a run on their money because of the fact that they are always leveraged. Again, I'm not a finance guy. I'm an engineer. But I understand math. And as soon as I knew that, I knew that there was a possibility, but I still thought that they would find a way to actually stay solvent. So I had to go to my team 24 hours later and say I was wrong. But I still told them that I have faith in the system. This is what makes this country so unique, right? Which is that you have to trust the system and you have to believe that if you haven't done anything wrong, that you're most likely to stay out of trouble. So what was amazing was what happened afterwards in terms of the people that came to us. Again, you asked about VCs, right? This is how you pick VCs. The first thing they told us is, when is your next payroll and how much money do you need? That's the quality of venture capitalists that we have in our industry. So when you pick them, you know, look at what they've done in the past and make sure that you have that implicit trust, you know, just like what you have in your founding team. So our VCs essentially said, you know, and by the way, the part that made it really, really interesting is our VCs' money was in SVB as well. But they just said, we'll find a way. Just tell me how much money you need by next week. By a twist of fate, actually, our payroll was not on that Monday, but the Monday after. So I told them, I don't need any money right now. Let's wait for the weekend and let's wait for Monday, and I'll tell you how much money we need to pay our bills. So it was that Friday was very tough because we literally had access to no money. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners would know that these banks have balance control requirements that, you know, if you have venture debt, which by the way, we had, but we had not drawn down on it. So we had a venture debt instrument in place, but we had not drawn down on it. But just because we had it, we had to put all our money in one place. And that's something that's never going to happen again. But what was very interesting is Saturday afternoon, 2:30, when Janet Yellen goes up there and says, nobody's going to lose money. So the saying we always have around here is, you know, our dollar bills say, in God we trust. But to believe in God, we do need the Treasury Department there.
My God, absolutely. So Amish, I'm putting you now into a time machine and I'm bringing you back to the late 90s when you got started with your first company. And you're able to give that younger Amish one piece of advice for launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
I have a lot to say, but let me say just one thing, which is trust your instinct. You know, one thing that we always tend to do is we tend to second guess ourselves. And nobody is going to believe in something that you don't see, right? In our business, it's not necessarily seeing it is believing. It is usually believe it and then you will see it. So trust your instinct to make the right call about what is it that you strongly believe in. Because if you believe in something, you'll be able to find other people that are like you will believe in it, and then you'll make it a reality.
I love it. I love it. So Amish, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, you're always welcome to reach out to me on LinkedIn. Just ping me. I'm happy to provide any kind of help that I can. One of the things that we believe as a community very strongly is it's all about giving back. I mean, that's one of the biggest reasons why I got into seed investing as well, because, you know, somebody did it with me and I owe it to the community to do it with others. So I may or may not be able to invest, but I can absolutely put you in touch with the right people, the right ecosystem to make sure that you can get your ventures off the ground.
Amazing. Well, Amish, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.